Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Kate Young here. Welcome to Earth Eats. On today's show, we check out a $3 dinner at our local natural foods co-op, which gets us thinking about the cost of food. Why is the healthiest food usually the highest priced? Why is junk food so cheap? And why are farmers struggling to make ends meet? We'll also take advantage of a fleeting spring blossom and turn it into a lovely preserve. And Harvest Public Media has a farm bill update. That's all coming up, so stay tuned. Alex Chambers, what's in the news this week?
Hi, Kate. We've got soil tillage and partially hydrogenated vegetable oils. It's an exciting week. But really, these things do matter. It's about slowing down climate change and reducing heart disease around the world. What do you want to hear first?
Tell me about hydrogenated oils.
You got it. The World Health Organization wants to cut back on fat. So it launched a campaign last Monday to get industrially produced trans fatty acids out of the global food supply by 2023. The WHO said trans fats, often called partially hydrogenated vegetable oil, have contributed to 500,000 deaths a year from heart disease, with a large number of those in developing countries. The food industry uses trans fats they produce from vegetable oils like soybean and cottonseed to harden foods like margarine and increase the shelf life of baked goods and snack foods. But trans fats increase bad cholesterol in the body, and diets high in those fats lead to increased risk of heart disease and death. Industry group International Food and Beverage Alliance supported the WHO campaign. The Food and Beverage Alliance represents companies like General Mills, Kellogg's, Mars, and McDonald's. New York City banned industrially produced trans fats 10 years ago under Mayor Michael Bloomberg. The WHO plan was developed with help from Vital Strategies, a global health advocacy group that Bloomberg's foundation supports. Several countries have already curbed or banned trans fats, including Denmark, Switzerland, Canada, and Britain. The WHO announcement comes as the U.S. prepares for a complete ban on trans fats, set to take effect next month. New research from Iowa State University shows Midwest farmland is storing less and less carbon due to expanding tillage over the past century and a half. And more carbon in the atmosphere leads to climate change. One way to mitigate that is no-till techniques. Ben Gramig is a researcher at the University of Illinois. He says many farmers are already using no-till for economic reasons. And if tilling stopped altogether, he says,
there's no question that it would be a significant contribution.
Gramig does warn that farmers could undo years of carbon storage with a single till. And that's the news. Later in the show, we'll hear a bit about the farm communities that grow the soybeans for that partially hydrogenated oil. In the meantime, thanks to Chad Bouchard and Harvest Public Media for those stories.
Thanks, Alex. The U.S. House of Representatives is looking at the massive bill which funds agriculture and nutrition programs for 5 years, also known as the Farm Bill. Already, the debate's been contentious, mainly over changes to nutrition assistance, which accounts for most of the Farm Bill dollars. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer has more.
Conservation programs also face significant changes. Iowa Republican Steve King says his amendment, passed by a voice vote, would let drainage districts compete for federal conservation dollars. But Ricardo Salvador of the Union of Concerned Scientists says that's an example of how agribusinesses respond when they see openings for local and state governments to potentially create different policies.
They essentially say, let's devise a rule that we can live with, but that actually preempts what individual states are doing. Let's not fight this battle 50 times. Let's go for some federal legislation. And then that sets the bar.
The Senate has yet to introduce its version of the Farm Bill. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Find more on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org.
Spring in southern Indiana, and this is Chef Daniel Lort, Farm Bloomington Restaurant. Today, Kate and I are going to be playing with some black locust flower.
Note, he did not say lotus blossom, nor are we talking about locusts, the grasshopper-like insect that swarms and wreaks havoc on cropland. We're talking about a fragrant and lacy flower cluster that drips off the branches of the black locust tree in May here in southern Indiana.
They come out for a couple weeks of the year, usually mid-May, and the whole countryside smells of this kind of wonderful sweetness. The aroma reminds me of a Rhine wine, a sweet, almost maybe a Concord grape.
If you're wondering how to identify a locust tree, just look up. They're the tall trees, the ones with the dark bark, and they're covered in shimmering white flowers. They're easy to spot this time of year because most of the other trees have already leafed out. The blossoms are edible. The syrupy aroma suggests a sweet application, but I have seen recipes that treat the blossom more like those of a pea plant and use them in savory dishes such as a summer pea soup. In the past, I've made locust blossom fritters, which basically amounts to a funnel cake with flowers in them. I've also candied them by painting each blossom with sugar water and letting them crystallize into a lovely decoration for, say, a cupcake. Not the most practical approach. Chef Daniel Orr says he uses them for edible garnishes on salads in the restaurant. He also makes a white wine locust blossom jelly, and he's going to show us how it's done. The first step is to locate some low branches on a black locust tree and harvest some flowers.
What I do is I go up and I cut off a couple tall branches, and then I pull the flowers off. And if you have the time, you can pull them all the way off the little green stems. I definitely do that if I was just going to eat them. But for this, I don't think it makes a difference. They don't have a bitter taste. You don't want to have any of the leaves in there, though. You aren't going to wash these, because if you wash them, you're going to wash away all that aroma. They're very delicate. So what you do, combine the 4 cups of packed black locust flowers with 2 cups of dry white wine and 1 cup of water. And you're going to bring that to a boil, and you're going to let that sit overnight, and it's going to steep and make a tea. Then you're going to squeeze out those flowers through a cheesecloth or through a very fine strainer. So it's basically you've made a tea. And you're going to carefully pour that tea after you've strained it off, because the pollen and any little impurities will stay at the bottom of that juice. Then you're going to mix it with 4 tablespoons lemon juice, 1 box sure gel, bring to a boil, and then you're going to add 4 cups of sugar. Once you bring that sugar to a boil, you're going to let it boil very rapidly for 1 minute. Then you're going to have your sterilized jars ready. You're going to put a couple of those locust flowers in your jars and ladle over that syrup. And then what I like to do is I turn the jars upside down, so then the flowers aren't floating on the top of the jar. So I like to have the flowers, you know, at the bottom, and then once it sits up, then I turn it back over, and then the flowers are kind of left floating throughout the jelly. If you want to keep these shelf stable, you'll need to follow your basic canning procedures. with your hot water and boil. Otherwise, you can keep this in the fridge for about a month. This jelly is very, very delicate. It's great on scones. If you're going to have like a little high tea party or something, it's a great thing for that. It's very floral. It's very kind of Victorian feeling to it. I also like to serve it with melon. I like to serve it with fresh berries. It's good on ice cream. You can glaze different things with it. And there's a couple other ways you can use this flour. I also took a bunch of these and I put them in my dehydrator. And I dehydrated them and I'll use them for making my own tea blends. And it's really amazing how much, when you dehydrate them properly, how much aroma they keep inside them. Then you need to keep them in a very tightly sealed jar in a cool, dark place. And then you can add them with other things. We'll have the elderberry flowers coming on, elderflowers. They'll be on in probably 2 or 3 weeks. You know, I save those and dry those. And then you get your mints, and then you can really put together a really nice herbal tea.
Chef served the locust blossom jelly with warm biscuits.
These are some of my great-grandma Wolf's buttermilk biscuits from Gibson County, Indiana, fourth generation.
Absolutely delightful. Delicate and floral, just as he described. But don't take my word for it. Break off a few clusters of black locust blossom for yourself and try this recipe. But don't delay. Seize the moment. These blossoms will be gone in the blink of an eye. We'll post photos of the flowers, the jelly, and of course, the recipe. All on our website, eartheats.org. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, @EarthEats. And if you have a moment, leave us a review on iTunes or send us your thoughts about the show. EarthEats@gmail.com. Production support comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeigner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. We went out to eat the other night. We had a lot going on.
After this, you're going to your class.
It starts at 6.
You have to be at practice at 7. I have to be somewhere at 7:15.
So we met at our local co-op, and my son and I got dinner. Carl had already eaten.
What'd you get, Cosmo?
I got penne pasta, garlic roasted chicken, and broccoli and carrots.
We got 2 plates of dinner.
$6.48.
The best part, it was only $3 each.
What we're going for is to make a very inviting place where people know they can get good, healthy food for not much money. Definitely want to make it something people feel like they can bring their families to and just have a good time, get some good food.
That's Maggie Sullivan. She's the president of the Board of Directors for Blooming Foods here in Bloomington, Indiana.
Blooming Foods is a cooperatively owned grocery. It's a democratically and locally controlled business, and our business is to sell groceries and healthy food.
A few weeks ago, I talked with Maggie and the store's interim general manager.
Hi, I'm Dee Bowler, and I'm the interim GM for Blooming Foods.
$3 dinners are a new thing here. The hot bar's been around for years with its high-quality soups, entrees, side dishes, and a full salad bar. The thing is, it costs $8.99 a pound. So it was a surprise to find a whole meal for $3, especially since the co-op, I'm just going to say it, has a bit of a reputation around town for being expensive.
We know we have that reputation sometimes.
And they wanted to fight that image and make the place more accessible for everyone. So they started looking around for ideas.
We actually stole the idea from another co-op, I think in Durham, North Carolina, and our previous general manager, Tony Alangi, was out there for a conference, and he checked it out, and he was just amazed to see people lined up to enjoy this great food and to have this sort of community feel of people coming out to the co-op to get their $3 dinner.
The chef behind these affordable meals for a crowd is Jordan Maxedon, the deli manager for the West Side store.
Most of the food is all from scratch because he feels like he can control the ingredients better. Some of the items aren't as intricate as our hot bar, but he feels that they're good, wholesome meals, and that's what we're striving for.
Can you just kind of walk through how it works?
We set it up where the hot bar normally is. It's not our normal hot bar, so they'll have a choice of proteins. We try to have items there for a vegetarian, and then we have a starch and a vegetable. So it's 3 to 4 items.
I asked about sourcing. I wanted to know if the ingredients were the same quality as what they get for their regular hot bar.
Some of that is different. We couldn't afford to put locally raised chicken, for instance, on the hot bar. And yet there have been times we have, and when we do, we put that on the sign so people are aware of that. But he sources the best products he can for the price.
Were you surprised by the success of this event?
I have to say I was. I was a little skeptical in the beginning because I thought, what can we put together that people are going to like for $3?
Everyone is surprised. Because cheap food is usually not good food.
Because we are a smaller store and we are not part of a larger corporation, we don't have the economies of scale that a business like a Kroger would. And we also are trying to offer higher quality products when we can, so a lot of local, a lot of organic. It's always challenging to deal with this, the food system. How do we make food accessible and affordable while still paying a fair wage to the people who produce it and producing high-quality food using organic and sustainable growing methods? And there's always a little bit of tension there that can be challenging to work around.
You brought up, Maggie, that tension that exists in when you're dealing with sustainable food and dealing with a store like Blooming Foods where you're trying to do good all across the food system. So you're wanting to pay people good wages, you're wanting to pay for the high quality. You know, it costs more to raise food in a sustainable manner.
Exactly.
If you're getting something local and you're getting it from a small farmer. What you talked about with the issues of scale.
Right.
And it's something that has really been on my mind a lot. What is affordable food? And we're not paying
the
generally
true price
right
of what it costs to produce food. Yeah.
Okay, so when we get a cheap meal at McDonald's or we pick up a frozen pizza from Kroger, we're not actually paying what it costs.
Right now, food is incredibly cheap. Food is probably cheaper than it's ever been.
Some food, that is. Maybe not that nutritious, sustainably raised, fair wages food that Maggie was talking about. But let's face it, there's a lot of cheap food out there. To find out why, we need to step back from the grocery store and head out to the farm. We asked Tristan Quinn Thibodeau to help us do that.
I'm the campaigner for food security, land rights, and biofuels here at ActionAid USA.
A lot of it has to do with scale. The economy just isn't set up for small businesses to succeed.
If you're growing corn on 1,000 acres and you sell it to Cargill or Archer Daniels Midland or these big agribusiness companies, you won't make enough money just from selling your crop to pay your loans, make your car payments, to buy clothes, even to put, you know, groceries on the table.
He recently went with the organization to talk with farmers in Iowa.
One thing we saw that shocked us, and I think it's something that you see in rural communities across the country, is just the loss of small business, the loss of vibrant main streets, the loss of schools. You know, a lot of the people moving out of rural areas, you just see the total collapse and disintegration of a lot of rural society. And it comes because of this, the concentration and the consolidation that's happened in agriculture.
When we talk about farming and when we talk about farmers in the U.S., certain images might come to mind, kids gathering eggs from the chicken coop, teenagers milking cows in the barn every morning, or maybe a sun-ripened tomato on the vine, and the idea of farmers feeding people.
But farming practices have changed dramatically from that kind of pastoral family farm ideal. Can you talk about what has changed and talk about what farming looks like today in the U.S.?
In parts of the country that we think of as farm country, there's been a lot of consolidation, so much consolidation and so much specialization in farms. And so where you used to have a farm where they would grow some grain, like corn or oats or soybeans, and they'd rotate them, and they'd also have different livestock. They'd have chickens or goats and or pigs and cows. Now farms are dedicated to either one or the other. So they have acres upon acres, thousands of acres of corn or soybeans, or they have huge CAFOs, huge factory farms of livestock. And the result has been similar to what we see with other small businesses. For example, when Walmart moves in and can sell goods really cheap because they don't pay their workers a fair wage and they don't pay the workers, they manufacture their goods in developing economies where workers are paid even less. They're able to sell goods far below cost, and they're able to outcompete a lot of small businesses. So just like in retail, you've got the big box stores. In agriculture, you have the big agribusiness companies. And you have, in order to get by, farmers have to compete against each other, and they have to get bigger and bigger since the prices are so low.
Okay, so large-scale farming, which is to say agribusiness. Here in Indiana, just like Iowa, we grow a lot of corn. I love sweet corn.
The corn that's grown in Midwest states, the yellow dent corn, is very different than sweet corn. And you can't steam yellow dent corn and eat it at dinner. But that corn is the basis for important foods like you grind up that corn to make cornmeal for tortillas and for grits and other kinds of foods like that.
But that doesn't account for anywhere near all those miles and miles of corn that you see when you're driving through the Midwest.
Yeah, the majority of corn that's grown in the Midwest right now is grown for animal feed, for ethanol, for processed foods like high fructose corn syrup.
Changes how you look at all those rolling fields of farmland. Hardly any of those crops end up on people's plates. At least not directly. Not in a way that we can recognize them. Those crops start to look less like food and more like raw materials for industrial processing, including for food. As Tristan said, corn is in a lot of processed food. Turns out soy is too. Earth Eats associate producer Alex Chambers headed out to our neighborhood Kroger to get a sense for just how many foods really have soy and corn on their ingredient list.
Yeah, there were a lot. Most of the corn was either high fructose corn syrup or cornstarch. But what really surprised me was how many different foods had soy in them, usually soybean oil or soy lecithin. Here are some of the things I found. Blue cheese vinaigrette. Asian sesame vinaigrette. Ranch veggie dip. Roasted red pepper hummus. 2-bite sugar cookies. Patriotic frosted sugar cookies. Blueberry pie. Extra virgin olive oil cooking spray. Shrimp mac and cheese, Aunt Millie's home-style whole wheat bread, Thomas English muffins, blue raspberry Kool-Aid, grape jelly, cherry preserves, orange marmalade, Nesquik chocolate low-fat milk with no high-fructose corn syrup, it still had corn in it, fruit gushers, Hershey's syrup, Keebler.
Okay, so I guess we are eating some of that corn and soy, just not in an obvious way. So farmers should be fine, right?
Yoplait strawberry yogurt.
But they're not.
Citrus punch.
The specific way that the farm policy undermines family farmers is by encouraging farmers to overproduce. Because when farmers overproduce, the price that they can get paid for their crop, it falls way below the basic cost of their own production.
Which results in lower prices. Which explains why all those processed foods are the cheap foods.
Patriotic frosted sugar cookies. Blueberry pie. Ballpark Franks.
And fruits and vegetables and other whole foods cost more.
In Iowa, it's corn, it's soybeans, it's hogs, and chickens for eggs, and more, it's cattle. And they're all, you know, held in these big factory farms. And the impact on farmers is bad, the impact on the environment is bad, and the impact on communities is even worse.
It sounds a lot like what Maggie said about what small stores like Blooming Foods are up against when it comes to offering high-quality, affordable food.
How do we make food accessible and affordable while still paying a fair wage to the people who produce it and producing high-quality food using organic and sustainable growing methods?
The question is, how do we create a food system that supports farm communities, nourishes the people eating the food, and doesn't destroy the environment?
Krispy Kreme glazed donuts, Eggo waffles, frozen Swedish-style meatballs, Clif Bars.
Hamburgers. Sounds like the Farm Bill Committee has their work cut out for them.
Edie's chocolate peanut butter cup ice cream, Keebler fudge stripes, grape jelly, cherry preserves, orange marmalade, fruit gushers, Hershey's syrup, Keebler fudge stripes, Edie's chocolate peanut butter cup ice cream, Breyer's lactose-free vanilla ice cream, Yoplait strawberry yogurt, Sunny D citrus punch, ranch veggie dip, Ballpark Franks, hamburger buns.
Production support comes from The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. Earth Eats happens because of people like Eabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killow, Daniel Orr, the IU Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Maggie Sullivan, Dee Bowler, and Tristan Quinn Thibodeau. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm your host, Kate Young. Thanks for listening.